Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybrow, and today we're talking about Out of Salem by Hal Shreve. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Good afternoon, Adam.
Good afternoon, Ren.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to the podcast where I'm not going to introduce it by saying how long it's been. It's fine.
Time doesn't exist anymore anyway.
Yeah.
So we can't be held accountable for lapses of many months because, you know, it doesn't exist. It's fine.
Yeah, no, what is a month? Yeah. But we're here now and we are talking about a recent novel called Out of Salem, which is a young adult queer horror novel written by Hal Shreve and published in 2019, which I'm very excited about.
Yeah, get ready for a lot of wholesome content, because it's a very good-natured book.
Do you think?
Oh, God, disagreement already.
I mean...
Okay.
Well, okay, well, we'll get into it. I'll just say that this episode will have spoilers, and it's probably more relevant than usual as it was only published a couple of years ago and does have some plot twists that you might want to experience for yourself. So if you're interested, I do suggest you read it first and then this episode will still be here.
Snazzy.
And we should maybe also just put a few content warnings at the top of the episode, because I mean, it's not exactly darker than other things we've covered, because obviously we did read The Deptford Mice, but it's more rooted in real life trauma than some things that we've covered. So
it's has allegorical elements, but it's always very clear what's being allegoricalized.
So there's references to family death, bullying, kind of homophobia, kind of threatening bigotry and police violence, I guess, some of the main ones. I found this novel last summer because I was ransacking the young adult horror category of my library app, I read a few books that I thought were very good, including Wilder Girls by Rory Powers, which might be a future episode topic, but I think Out of Salem was my favourite, was definitely the queerest, so and kind of in terms of what we've talked about on the podcast so far, I think this reminds me most of Witch Week. It was the Diana Wynne Jones novel we read a while back.
There are bits which felt a little John Wyndham-y to me.
Yeah, I can see that too.
Definitely this theme of young people or kids up against adult institutions and the adult world. And not being able to know who to trust. And also...
I mean, that's like the main theme of our podcast, right?
Yeah, it really is. and also, I guess, kind of... I want to call it like a mini-epic. But like that's something I think you get in Wyndham. Like, you know, you don't necessarily journey across a great geographic expanse. while you're reading it, it may feel kind of static, but then by the end of it, you actually feel like you have gone on quite a journey.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. The reason I was thinking of Witch Week is the kind of atmosphere of it. It sort of has this slightly downbeat, sort of chilly kind of atmosphere. And I think they both sort of share the sense that they're set in a world that's kind of gone wrong somewhere. Like, in Witch Week, they're sort of burning witches at the stake, and in Out of Salem, they're sending zombies to the incineration station. Sort of, yeah, world that's like ours, but something's gone strange.
Yeah, that's interesting, because the world definitely is a really cold one. I would agree with that. But I think I found Shreve's authorial voice seems really kind of inclusive and sort of nurturing or encouraging to me. That I might be wrong, but to me, it really feels like a book written by someone who's writing a book for their younger self, almost.
Uh-huh.
Like writing a book thinking, this is a book I wish had existed when I was a kid. And so even though it is bleak, for me, I felt there was, you know, I was, until I guess the last quarter, maybe, reluctant to call it a horror, if I'm honest.
Okay.
Because I don't know, it's there's a lot of danger and peril for the characters, and I can see how it is an upsetting read, but at the same time, I always felt like I felt like the author that Shreve wants the reader to have a pretty nice time.
Hmm.
It didn't have, so for instance, ostensibly the water babies, you know, should be a much lighter, easier read, but it's written by someone who clearly, I don't know, you know,
hates you.
Hates children and hates you, right? Whereas, I don't know, reading it, it felt, quite a good-natured book, I thought.
Hmm. I mean, I can see what you mean, but I thought it had less of the, like, it kind of obviously is a kind of found queer family narrative, but I found it less on the cozy end of that genre. I thought it was quite sort of unsentimental about the characters, you know, like,
yeah,
they're not particularly nice to each other all the time.
maybe it's just because I've read so much Megan Mogg during lockdown. So I do, and if you're under 18 listening to this, you probably shouldn't read Megan Mogg, if I'm honest. I mean, I guess you might anyway, but Megan Mogg during lockdown, I guess the characters are so vile to each other. I did read that every day. Simon Hanselman's, you know, work rate is ridiculous. So he managed to do it every day for like the last half a year or something.
Yeah.
And that might have somewhat messed up my sense of how characters should treat each other.
Right.
Oh, the characters haven't left each other dead in a dump, so they're really nice.
So from a spectrum of Steven Universe to Megan Mogg, this is somewhere in the middle.
Okay, that's fair. I think that's maybe what gave it a slightly like 90s feel to me. Is the way the characters talk to each other. Like, that sometimes almost brought to mind like House of Stairs,
for
instance. Yeah. You know, and these characters who, yeah, some of them are kind of sympathetic, but yeah, you know, they don't always say or do nice things.
Yeah. To clarify, this is set in the 90s. I didn't realize this until about halfway through the book on the first read. It's not kind of, it's not like thrown in your face. but yeah, it's not going full like, oh, what's that show that's set in the 80s? Stranger Things.
You know, I think it is written to a modern teen audience.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not written for millennials to read and be nostalgic about reading.
But yeah, set in the 90s, the characters are monsters in a secretly monsters in a small town that hates them. It's kind of where we're starting. I think the book has a really great opening line. I've been doing quite a lot of creative writing recently, and I just want to give props to this opening line, which is the morning of the funeral, Z's Uncle Hugh made 8 pots of bitter coffee. I'm like, yeah, that's great. Like, one sentence, we have an intriguing event, we've got 2 characters with names, and like just the phrase like 8 pots of bitter coffee, that sounds great, suggests atmosphere. Yeah, good work.
And it's a faintly southern gothic as well. Like, it feels like it would be out of place in Faulkner or something.
Yeah. So yeah, we've got this funeral. There's been an accident. Z, our main character, is still here, but the rest of their family have died, and Uncle Hugh is their only relative. And on the second page, we see the results of a quiz that Z has taken from a website called transsexual.org, classifying their gender identity as androgyn. So although other characters call them Susan sometimes and she, they are really Z and they, and the narrative calls them that.
Yeah, I found it interesting that because it's set in the 90s, and maybe a little jarring, I was wondering what you thought of it, and the fact that obviously transsexual tends to be the term that's used in the book.
Yes, well,
which isn't used as much now. I know it's somewhat has come back.
Yes, it's getting a bit of a revival among some people, but is not generally considered the term. But it was in the 90s; it was pretty common. There was a 90s. Like sort of radical trans organization called Transsexual Menace, who were about and who did things like kind of protested at the funeral of Brandon Tina, who was murdered, the trans man who was murdered. Yeah, so it was it's period accurate. I definitely saw some Goodreads reviewers objecting to it, but trans terminology changes like every 5 minutes, so I think you can't really expect a book set 30 years ago to have terminology that everyone's happy with now.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, I thought that was useful. I was worried that there would be too much info dumping in the book, and there definitely isn't. Mm. So, you know, it doesn't feel, because I think it's partly on the back. The review from Kat Fitzpatrick, says Shrew's book's much more than just a good young adult read. It's also, in the best possible sense, an educational experience.
Huh.
And when I read that, I thought, oh, is this going to be, you know, kind of edutainment-y in a way? And it doesn't read like that, actually.
No.
You know, it might be education, like a kind of emotional education, possibly. Or, you know, a young reader might find things that resonate with them, or, you know, terms that make sense to them or help them make sense of stuff. But, you know, it's certainly not, like, really overtly educational, I wouldn't
no,
say.
No, not at all. I think it airs on the leaving things a mystery side of the exposition curve, you know?
Yeah, I'd agree. Yeah.
So yeah, you get just this little bit about little like printout that Z's got from the internet, but that's really, and they talk to, you know, they talk to people throughout the book a bit about their gender, but it's not like, yeah, sit down kids, we're learning here.
Yeah, it feels perfectly integrated, and it's you know, a facet of Z's character along with lots of other facets. The characterization was probably my favorite thing about the book. I did find the characters believable. And I think I felt like I grew to understand them more over the course of the book, basically, which is nice. You know, young adult fiction doesn't always achieve that, I think.
Yeah, with also a fair bit of plot as well.
It's definitely not like, I think the pacing at the start is a little, I felt it settled, right? So at the start, I thought there were bits which felt very fast and then a bit slower. I definitely got into it the more I read. Like, I felt by about a quarter of the way in, it had really found its groove. And
So although Z is still here after the accident, they are not alive. And the way we find that out is this... is a scene in the church that actually really made me like literally gasp in shock when I first read it. I think it's amazing. I'm going to read a bit. Hugh makes Z go to church, and as the service goes on, their eye starts itching, and says, "Their right eye suddenly really hurt. They reached up to touch the contact lens and pull it out, but they couldn't find where the lens ended and their eye began. They began poking at their eye, aware that several people were still staring. They poked their finger into their eye. The contact lens would not move. Z scraped at their eyeball with two fingers instead, hoping to gain purchase on the small rubbery lens. Suddenly, Z's right eyeball came out into their hand. They stared down with their left eye. It took a moment to figure out what it was. There was some gooey blood on their palm." This novel goes pretty hard on the body horror, which I'm into.
I thought it was fun. If I'm honest. Peter said that happened to his gran. I don't think it's church. I think she was on the phone and she'd been pressing it on her eye and she just popped it out. And apparently. Apparently she could still see with it out of its socket. So the description in the book, with Z still able to see even though the eye was dangling, is accurate. So that's good to know as well. Another educational aspect of the book.
So I'm like, this was shocking, and Adam's like, well, yeah, sounds like an everyday event to me. Cool. Well, I don't know if Peter's gran was a zombie, but Z is a zombie.
As I am, technically.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, revelation, listeners. Your co-host, Adam, is I think, technically a zombie, because I did die as I was born like 3 months prem, and I was very delicate. Was in an incubator and such, and my heart stopped and my breathing stopped for I think over 3 minutes.
Wow.
Which I think means technically I medically died. Don't quote me on that, but I remember my mum saying something of this sort. We zombies walk among.
Well, congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah. You know, just living my life, being a zombie.
When Z's uncle sees that Z's popped their eye out of their socket, he gets very angry and starts shaking them for causing a scene. An elderly woman called Mrs. Dunnigan steps in to be Z's caretaker instead. I really liked Z's relationship with Mrs. Dunnigan. I found it quite poignant.
Yeah, I mean, Mrs. Donegan's great.
Yeah, she's great.
that helps. But yeah, I really liked that it's simultaneously nurturing but not sentimental.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mrs. Donegan is quite elderly. She's running a bookshop. She's not in the best health, and she kind of tries to look after Z, but her flat's a mess, and they like end up eating pickles and toast for dinner. And at one point she says, we both have to work hard to stay alive, don't we? which I really liked. And that kind of felt like one of the themes of the book. Like, you know, for lots of reasons, the characters have to work quite hard to stay alive.
Yeah.
Whether it's because of disability or old age or because of other people's cruelty. Or, I liked it.
Yeah. She reminded me, Miss Donegan, of some of the kind of more experienced older activists in Extinction Rebellion that I've met.
Yeah.
Like the ones who, you know, been, you know, were hippies back in the 60s and have been at it for years and years and years.
Yeah, she reminds me a little bit of my 90-something-year-old Francesca, who is a Quaker, who... whenever I talk to her, so it starts conversations like, so Ren, what do you think the meaning of life is? and I love her.
One of the members of my Unitarian congregation, Beryl, who's also in her 90s and always says that her long life is due to her drinking Guinness. says that if she's ever interviewed by tell us the secret of how you've lived so long, and she's going to say that it's Guinness.
Yeah, I this is a hardcore old people appreciation podcast.
Yeah,
particularly queer ones. Mrs. Donegan is a lesbian as well.
And Z makes a friend as well.
Yes, I mean, Z makes a friend eventually called Azel, who they're quite suspicious of each other at first, but eventually come to be friends. Who's the sort of the other main protagonist? Who is an unregistered werewolf? Only her mom knows that she's a werewolf. In the sort of Azel storyline, we sort of see her meeting the first other werewolf she's ever met, who a couple of older teenagers called Chad and Elaine, who are both runaways, kind of living nomadically to avoid detection and electric shock therapy. Elaine kind of explains to Azel and the readers kind of what the general situation is like for young werewolves. And she says, for most of us, it's like a little hospital, a touch of juvie, and then more hospital till your brain turns black and your magic curls up inside your muscles and dies. I ran away before I was old enough to get shocked more than twice a year. And even then, my magic got pretty messed up. I still have like magic arthritis and a bunch of pain problems. This is kind of generally how we find out about the world of the story. It's just these little snippets of things that people say, but it's really interesting the bits we get, like from a school lesson, and then like Virginia Woolf and Ernest Hemingway were werewolves.
I like that.
We learn. There were werewolf riots in the 1920s, and then a generation of radical werewolves in the 1960s that the government put down. On the sort of zombie front, there's another school lesson talking about 300 warlocks of Irish and Chinese descent employed by Northern Pacific, who had assisted in the construction of the railroad through Stampede Pass, went on strike after their wages were withheld. Their numbers were not significant enough to prevent the use of the railroad, so they raised a group of 40 dead former citizens who were buried in the cemeteries of Portland and Clackamas. It's just great.
Yeah, I like the precision of it, and like how kind of everyday it is as well. Like, it makes it really convincing.
Yeah, it's great world building. We sort of learn, because there's sort of anti-monster reactionary protests in the town, and we learn that in New York, werewolves have to observe a curfew on their nights adjacent to the full moon and have to lock themselves inside during it. And from Mrs. Dunnigan, we learn a little bit about sort of history beyond the United States with her. She was in Ireland, their relation to magical beings, how kind of in becoming a republic, they distanced themselves from sort of the British hostility to magic and accepted people like shapeshifters and selkies. And I was like, yeah, that's super interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that was really nice. I mentioned to Antonia that it was really nice to see selkies in an American young adult fiction novel. That was unexpected. And
oh yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, I just thought it showed like the sort of even like as a gesture sort of interest to outside of America's borders. I thought that was cool.
I think, I don't know, I won't recount the whole plot because I think I'm trying to do a thing where I don't spend half the episode reading out a plot summary.
I think your plot summaries are very good.
Okay. I do have notes, so if you... But I feel... I worry I'm boring people just like, and then this happened, and then this happened. We can... I think there's quite a lot to talk about sort of thematically, and can describe bits of the plot as we go. I love the wolf gut zine.
That was really great. It's a really convincing 90s scene.
Later in the book, Aesel meets up with Elaine and sort of visits the house where Elaine and the other mostly werewolves are squatting in. And some of them are making a zine called Wolf Guts 3, which includes things like where to get healthcare, legally or illegally, which doctors to see if you feel like you want to try experimental drugs, how to avoid cops, where to go during moons, that kind of thing. And some of the articles are Punk Rock and Lycanthropy, How I Survived Prison, The Real History of Werewolves. And it's just, I want to read this scene. It sounds great.
Yeah, that would be a great little tie-in promotional
item. I looked, I was like, has anyone made this? You know?
I mean, maybe you're the person. Maybe you, if you're listening to this, Hal Shreve, and thank you if you are. I can't think of a better person to make such a thing as myself.
But yeah, that's made me very happy. I guess we can talk a bit about the queerness of it. It is obviously a big thing about the book is that there is a wide range of queer and trans characters in this novel. We have Z, who is genderqueer, androgyn. We have Aesel and Mrs. Dunnigan are lesbians. Chad and Elaine are a trans guy and a trans woman. We're both teenagers in like the early mid 2000s, and I haven't got used to this level of representation.
Yeah, that's really true. I like the fact, as I said, it feels really integrated, and like they also, felt like queer 14-year-olds, mm-hmm. the two main characters. I guess, you know, almost what's worth talking about is the fact that it's, you know, it's just done in a really nice, straightforward,
mm-hmm.
and I think quite nurturing sort of way.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe because it's, you know, it's very much written by a queer author rather than, you know, it's clearly not committee written, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it clearly hasn't been written with a, hey, how do we expand our markets to reach the queer demographic?
Yeah.
Which is when I think stuff does feel forced or you know, just insincere. And because there's not a hint of that,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, it does feel, like, incredibly just, yeah, of course, that it's, you know, it's queer characters, people are queer, people are trans, it's, you know, and, yeah. But then, you know, I just, like, have to stop for a moment and be like, wait a moment. You know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I am non-binary. I feel like I don't... Hello, I'm coming out in episode 38. Maybe hasn't actually come up on the podcast before, but having a genderqueer character who uses they-them pronouns, it's just cool.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, representation matters.
Yeah,
and,
I think Hal Shreve does a really great job.
It's interesting. I think... I don't know how I'm going to express this. Okay. Like, it's not super... So the writing style is pretty straightforward, I would say. Which doesn't mean it's bad. I think sometimes it's very effective. I probably like a little more fruity writing than you get... I do like some purple prose, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
So sometimes it was a little bit sort of straightforward and plain in its style. My tastes. But at the same time, okay, I think one of maybe the danger, I don't know if it's a danger, maybe one of the dangers of, like, queer culture online and, like, I guess the mass popularity of things like RuPaul's Drag Race is a kind of maybe over-aestheticization.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, obviously aesthetics are super important, you know, mm-hmm. I don't want to say aesthetics don't matter, but you know, they're one thing amongst many, and I think sometimes, hyper focus on aesthetics can, I don't know, obscure other things. Like, I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is, I like the fact that these characters aren't, like, necessarily super cool or anything. Like, you know, they're not always managing to be fabulous and living their best lives. You know, like,
yeah. Yeah,
you know, like it's not like it's not like some wildly aspirational read, say.
Yeah, and it's not neither is it like total queer trauma, like they're all like having a horrible time specifically because they're queer.
Yeah, it doesn't, I think it manages to, yeah, it doesn't do either of those things.
Yeah, and it also manages to you know, I think it threads the needle quite well between, you know, like the, you know, the monster, that they are monsters, and, you know how it's kind of easy to use, like, being monsters as an allegory for being queer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
And, like, in this book, they are monsters and queer, and we get some sort of interesting interactions of those two things, right? That those
I really like the fact that it, because that was my fear when I started reading, right? Mm. That it was going to be heavy-handed and that you just have this sort of allegory which was quite potentially an obvious one that's been done before, that it doesn't quite work in an allegorical way, I think.
Mm.
Which, you know, which is really to the novel's credit. Yeah, obviously it's always drawing these parallels, but yeah, it, as you say, like, they are queer and monsters.
Mm. We get, yeah, like a... I don't know, this was maybe the only one that I thought, like, a glimpse of kind of how the sort of magic of the world intersects with the being trans specifically was like a throwaway comment by Elaine talking about well-off trans women who were getting potion treatments and magical alterations. And I was like, oh, wow, I want to hear more, you know, I want to learn more. Like, how does being trans work in this world? But there's, you know, anyway.
Mm. Yeah, as you say, the world building tends to be sort of glimpsed, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the references and gestures that are made, these hints you get in lines of dialogue rather than being explicitly descriptive. Like,
yeah,
there is a lot of dialogue.
I think it is admirably restrained, really, because you could really go off on a whole thing about... about trans magical yeah, things.
It's definitely a book that invites fan fiction.
Oh yeah,
like, you know, like, gosh, if this book becomes really popular, I can really imagine a lot of fanfic being written out of this.
Yeah. Shall we texture it?
Yeah, go on then. What do I Oh, I've got something to slosh around, which is good because of the selkies in this book. So.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I was sloshing a bottle of ink, but I don't know if I heard it at all.
Oh, nice. Well, it was some days-old water.
Do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I've got quite a simple one, but an effective one, which is the cobwebby texture when Z experiences the invisibility spell.
Ooh, yeah.
Because I thought I've encountered lots of invisibility spells in, you know, in fantasy books and films, etc. But I've never, to my memory... heard it described in terms of what it would feel like as a physical sensation.
Mm.
Especially, not that I remember. And I just really like that, the idea of it feeling like a kind of cobweb kind of draped around one, like a sort of cobweb armour.
Mm.
I found really evocative and worked for me in terms of imagining what it might feel like to have this invisibility magic working on you.
Yeah, yeah.
What about you?
Well, I actually need to explain a bit of plot to to talk about my one, which is one of the main bits of plot, really, is that Zee has brought back from the dead, but because their mother put a spell on them, but the spell wasn't particularly well done, and Zee's body is degrading. Without renewing it, Z would eventually sort of just crumble to bits. So one of, yeah, the main plot threads is that Z trying to find a spell that can prolong their life in this environment where any information about necromancy or about the condition of being a zombie is highly forbidden. Yes, as you mentioned, they with help from their teacher, Mr. Weber, they sneak into the library to try and steal the books on necromancy. This is explaining so much plot, but they find they're already it's gone. Okay. The books aren't there, but Mr. Weber ends up getting arrested. But then Tommy, who's a character we haven't talked about yet, who's sort of the third kind of main kid character, who is another kid at school who is bullied for being kind of weird and effeminate. It turns out that he stole the books, and so he gives one to Z so they can make the spell to renew the spell that's keeping them alive. Okay.
Yep.
So they do it, and there's a potion, and the potion was my texture. Hey, the potion on their tongue was sweet and bitter at once. There was something happening in their mouth. It started with a buzzing that filled the spaces between their teeth like mechanical bees, and a drumming sound in their chest. Then it spread. Their forehead ached with novel temperatures, icy and then hot, their veins seared. So you suddenly felt their hands against the dirt of the ground. They had fallen over. It seemed like there was water seeping into them, like their flesh had become a sponge.
Oh, spongy flesh.
Spongy flesh. which is kind of a... there's quite a lot of good Z textures, but that's one of the less horrible ones. Because we kind of get all these sort of... Before they take the potion, we get these vivid descriptions of them kind of coughing up black sludge from deep in their lungs and sort of getting kind of dark spots of blood under their skin and kind of stumbling because they can't feel their feet. I thought that was pretty effective and unsettling, the descriptions of Z's sort of degrading.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like being in your 30s, eh?
Hey!
Yeah, I mean, I really like how those descriptions are almost always from Z's point of view.
Mm.
So the body horror is really sort of coming from Z. Like, it's not... Because one of the risks of the body horror is that it really others the character, right? Or makes them kind of... grotesque and alien. I think this is like the issue with David Cronenberg's work, right? In that on some level, it feels like it's embracing radical otherness and it's really excited by body horror. But on another level, it feels like it has this kind of weird conservative kind of bent to it where, you know, we should feel disgusted by deformity.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there's this sort of odd tension between, you know, whether if you watch like David Cronenberg's body horror, like, you know, whether these are progressive or conservative, it's really hard to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what I liked here is that it's not other characters looking at Z and describing their body.
Yeah.
It's very much about how Z's experiencing this. I thought that was really effective and a classy way of doing body horror.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I hadn't considered that, but it's true. We do like occasionally get characters kind of reacting in sort of shock to Z's appearance, but it's not. It doesn't linger over what they see that they think is horrifying about Z. You know, it's just Z sort of sees them, kind of double take at you know, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
I think that's really good. I actually think that's, you know, actually quite innovative. Like, you know, I think Shreve's kind of found a way there to do body horror in a way that doesn't feel kind of ableist or regressive.
Yeah.
Which I actually think is quite a notable thing.
Yeah.
So great job.
Because I do. That is the tension with body horror, right? Like I enjoy it, but it's also it can get gross. And like I kind of there's you know things that I felt have crossed that line, like you know, like Attack on Titan.
Oh yeah, I'm never. My students talk about it, but I've never. I know what it is. But
yeah,
I've
never
actually watched it.
I don't know. I don't know if it was the second or third series, because there's these titans that sort of big monster people, and I just like after a while I felt it. The way they were depicting these kind of monstrous bodies and like the way they looked and the way they moved, it just kind of felt like it was kind of shading into like ableism, really. Just like, oh, they move in this atypical way kind of thing. Like, oh, yeah. Isn't that horrifying? Like,
yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that, I mean, it's something I've seen in anime and manga sometimes.
Mm.
Like, I'm definitely a big Junji Ito fan.
Mm-hmm.
But there are Junji Ito comics which I think move into that, and that if you're to read them with a critical eye, so yeah, actually this is ableism.
Mm.
And you know, it's not okay. Yeah, I guess it depends the degree to which you're kind of abstracting it from sort of everyday reality.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, like, this is always one of the issues of horror, right? Because often if you're writing something about what we're scared of, you know, reactionary politics and positions are often coming out of fear and ignorance.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's kind of a tricky thing, right? And especially if you're then going to sort of make the stuff aesthetic and be reveling in. I mean, you know, if we think right back to like Todd Browning's Freaks or something, like, you know, that's a film that I've seen both sides, people arguing that actually, you know, that the performers in the film are treated with a certain kind of dignity, and that, you know, they're clearly not the real freaks of the title, and, you know, the able-bodied characters behave in far more vile ways. And yet, at the same time, clearly if you look at the cinematography, there's shots in that film where the performers, you know, are being lit and shot in such a way as to look grotesque and scary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, same thing with American Horror Story, Freak Show.
Mm.
So yeah, you know, horror can
yeah
a bit of a digression. Sorry.
I enjoyed it.
Oh, good.
There's also some kind of interesting stuff with Z and Azel, and they're kind of, they come to be very close, but they kind of have this sort of suspicious relationship with each other at first, because they're kind of just thrown together by Mr. Weber, and they're sort of both convinced that the other has no idea what they're going through, which is kind of true, right? Because like Azel has kind of known that she's considered a monster for her whole life, and is also further othered by being fat and being Turkish in a very white small town, but she does have like a loving mother who's protecting her, and Z is kind of now sort of newly monstrous and kind of alone in the world apart from Mrs. Dunnigan. And I think it's done quite well, like the sort of tensions between their experiences and how they, you know, navigate that, and kind of they get sort of upset and frustrated at each other for not kind of understanding, you know, each other's position, but they also form quite a deep solidarity.
Yeah, I like that it shows, you know, mutual solidarity is possible, but it's not easy.
Yeah.
Necessarily.
Um, Yeah, do we want to talk about the kind of a sort of end of the kind of ending sort of bit, like the last sort of acts of the book?
To a degree, I mean, so you've mentioned that Aesil sort of falls in with, makes friends with these two homeless werewolves, and they're sort of part of this loose anarchist commune, I suppose, making these zines, most of whom are werewolves, there were some kind of hangers-on, and running through the book, there's this sort of fear, and bigotry that some of the townspeople have against werewolves. And this is sort of escalating and being kind of stoked up by the media, basically.
Yeah.
And then there's a police raid, basically, towards the end of the book. And I guess that's what sort of sets in motion the events of the book's last act.
Yeah. Because someone... someone's been killed earlier in the book by, or no, was it, was someone was bitten by a werewolf and then the werewolf was shot?
Yes, I think that's happened, and then and then someone's killed and werewolves are accused.
So then the police raid this this werewolf squat, it's intense.
It is. It's an upsetting scene.
You know, police are armed, and like Z is outside smoking and manages to escape, and Elaine and Aesil just manage to get away together. But the next day, they find out on the news that three of the people there were shot dead, including Chad, the who Elaine was traveling with, and the rest of them were arrested. And it's kind of at this point, kind of Z they've been getting closer with Tommy, but he sort of turns up and tells Z, Aesil, and Elaine his secret, which is that he's a shapeshifter and had been getting experimental treatment from Archie Pagan, who's the therapist who was killed earlier in the book. He'd stolen the books from the library by shapeshifting into animals.
Like the Animorphs.
Yeah, like an Animorph. but he reveals that it was actually him who killed Archie Pagan during a session. He shapeshifted into a kind of massive lion, and then he panicked and buried the body in the woods, and then werewolves were accused. But he also tells them that there was a hidden back room in Archie Pagan's office where this treatment happened, and where Archie kept his files on werewolves, and that he didn't think the cops had found it yet. So they decide to break in. And they kind of find this hidden room, and it's sort of wrecked and blood splattered, and they nearly get caught by a receptionist who calls the police, but they get out, and kind of Aesil sort of destroys this chair where people get strapped in to be shocked, and sort of sets the building on fire. And they get away, but then they see on the news that they didn't manage to fully destroy the evidence, and now the police have a lead. We mentioned Selkies, but we haven't mentioned that Mrs. Dunnigan turns out to be a Selkie. and she's been involved in this sort of anti-werewolf plot line because her bookstore has had a like window display about werewolf rights, and it's had a speaker saying like, oh, maybe we should treat werewolves all right, and so she's been targeted, and her store his window smashed in, I think. So these people are after her, and they she gets mailed a crate, which turns out to be her seal skin. If you're not familiar with the Selkie myth, I'm quite familiar with. I have a book called The People of the Sea, which is all Selkie stories. But yeah, it's a kind of Scottish and Irish, they're sort of women who come out who are seals. So they come out of the sea and they leave their seal skin, but then if their seal skin is returned to them, they have to return to the water. So as soon as she gets her skin, she's compelled to go back. So, you know, Mrs. Dunnigan leaves really abruptly. So Z's alone. And there's quite a nice little passage about that. It says, Z thinking, by now the water would have come up and closed over her head. By now she would be far out in the deep, salty, clean sea. Z prayed there was no oil slicks near the coast. Z thought of the miles of water, so cold and dark, and the sky above the sea, grey, and shivered. Yeah. Mrs. Dunnigan's gone back to the sea. So Z's kind of in Mrs. Dunnigan's flat alone and kind of tries to go back there after the werewolf raid, but the police are outside. So the only thing they can think to do is to go and see Mr. Webber. And he kind of ushers Z and Elaine and Tommy in, but tells them that it might be worse for them to come in because since he was arrested at the library, he's been under surveillance. And he says he'll put a cloaking spell on them and drive them to the train station and so they can get a night train to California. The kind of the only other option is to sort of undo the spell that's been holding Z's body together, which will kind of let off enough energy to transport everyone magically away. Mr. Webber's car starts to break down. A police officer comes by to see what's going on, sort of not suspecting them, but there's this kind of this monitoring orb that's going around, like that's like patrolling the street where Mr. Webber lives. And so their cover story gets exposed, and Mr. Webber's about to get arrested, but makes a portal and disappears. And just before he goes, he undoes the spell on Z. Something happens. Can you explain, Adam?
Police cars are on fire.
Yeah. Tommy's shape-shifting back and forth.
I'm ripping the space-time.
There's a huge amount of energy and kind of
chaos.
Shape-shifting galaxies, stars, magic, the universe. And sort of when it all settles again, they're still there, but there's no one there. They're in a wood. The city's disappeared. They start to walk towards the ocean.
Yeah, it sort of ends on this slightly melancholy note. Hard to know if it's leaving itself open for a sequel or not.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, they yeah, they walk, the three of them, four of them?
Four of them.
Yeah. Yeah, the four of them, in this, in this odd new environment. And,
maybe they've got transported to a better world, a softer world.
Yeah. I'll just read a bit. It says, they picked their way down the last rocky incline and landed on the hard, brown, wet beach. The water crashed onto the shore, dredging out brown and green seaweed and leaving, on its retreat, open pores in the air through which clams squirted. Aethel stood up and looked out at it. It had been years since she had been to the sea. Z turned to her. The first light of morning illuminated their face. "I think today is going to be better than yesterday," they said. And that's the end. And I think that's the end of my notes as well.
And possibly the end of the episode.
And possibly the end, even the end of the episode. Yeah. Unless we have any final thoughts.
Well, with the perhaps unsurprising revelation that Joss Whedon was just really horrible and harassing and bullying on the set of Buffy, you know, this could be the kind of replacement, maybe, to Buffy, I think.
Yeah.
You know, a Netflix version of this with many series. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, with that and with, obviously, the nonsense of J.K. Rowling, we need our own queer queer fantasy.
Yeah, and yeah, I do think.
And I'm,
so I wasn't sure at first, but I really did warm to it a lot. I think it's a very nifty book.
Yeah, no, I think it's great, and I think I feel like if I reread it again, I'm going to find more interesting things, little tidbits, and maybe I'll even write my own fan fiction for it at some point.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Cool. All right.
Awesome.
So I'll just our credits. Our intro music is Maki Yamazaki. Our outro music is Joe Kelly. Our artwork is Letty Wilson. You can find us on Twitter at StillScaredPod. Or potentially email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com, although I admit I haven't checked it in a while.
No, maybe remind me of the password. I'll check. I have loads of emails. Can you imagine?
Oh,
like,
God.
We got into it during lockdown. We had loads of emails. We hadn't replied.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry if you've emailed us, because
yeah,
have not checked that. obviously, you can rate and review us on Apple Podcasts if you want. Fine. No pressure, but, you know, it's nice.
Yeah.
And do you have a sign-off for us, Adam?
Oh, gosh. I was just going to say that, you know, young listeners, we're not boomers. Okay? we're millennials. just because I've had, you know, a couple of my students, I've had an okay boomer or two, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I made an Animorphs reference.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have done that if
we
I was
are firmly millennials, okay?
Yeah. we have way too many neuroses to be boomers.
Yeah.
Cool. Did you do the credits?
Yes. Yes, I just did.
Yeah. that's all then. Okay, thanks. Bye, everyone.
So, sign off, Adam. Adam, we want a sign off.
Oh, monster, monster. There you go.
Monster, monster. See you later, Spooky Kids.
Bye.
Bye.